Hi. Okay, we're good.
I didn't answer.
I'm putting up the volume.
You did, right? Yeah. I'm here.
Okay, you can hear me, right?
All right, bye.
Okay, perfect. Okay, but I can't hear you because you're muted, so it's okay. Okay, I am going to...
Yeah, move that thing.
I am going to move it. You'll probably just see the side of me, if that's okay, Winters.
No, you could...
Put it here? Okay. All right, we'll figure it out. Let's see what we can get.
My shoes here.
Are those more shoes?
Oh, that's a seat.
Oh, that works. Look at that. Can you hear me?
Hi, Sandy.
Winters, can you hear me? Okay.
Hi,
fabulous.
Sandy.
Everybody's saying hi. Oh, okay.
Hi. Are you coming?
Hey,
I don't
good
know
to see you.
Yeah. Hi, Olga, please.
Thank you.
Take the seat.
Welcome.
Wonderful.
Olga, I have two adorable little girls to come together.
Nice to see you. How's my olive? My Ava. Well, olive is olive.
The olive. Something else. Giving us
our time. just, I hate to head you off, but red wine, white wine, oh, decaf,
oh,
ice cold water.
You have decaf red wine? That is so
good. Yeah.
Okay.
I
never know.
I was going to try to have decom my or other, but her husband's not home yet.
Oh, so. Okay.
I'll
have an apple.
Maybe next time. Yeah,
decaf.
The kid over there.
Yeah,
he works in the
store.
Decaf?
So,
no. Really?
Yeah.
I think we got big, and so then all we need is pomegranate and stay and
rest it there.
We're just making fun of the Winters. Don't worry about it. All right, who we have here? Okay, so Muriel, Jill, you said? Perfect. Liz, Olga, great to see you. I don't think we've ever actually met,
no.
But your kids are adorable.
No, yeah.
I'm glad you. Okay.
Absolutely. Pam, Joe.
Tommy.
Tony. Tony.
Marcy.
Marcy, I remember. Perfect. Okay. Rabbi T, Tzvi Tachman, that's what they call me, Rabbi T. The easy way to remember it is rabbit. So on all my t-shirts in camp, it says Rabbi T, and all the kids come up to me and say, why are you a rabbit?
So. That explains a lot.
Right? Right? Because they kept telling me the rabbit, right? Thank you. But they won't forget it. And that's the beauty. That's great. That's why the email address, people won't forget. It's great. Anyway, thank you all for coming. I find it very exciting. I really do. I love coming out here. And as much as I joke about the fact that it's a long drive for me, I love it. I really do. It gives me a chance to clear my head from the day, usually. Tonight was unique. One of my, we'll call them students, has a paper that he needs to write. And it's a contrast of world religions or whatever. So he chose one of them being Judaism. And of course, who better to call than the rabbi? So I told him, he asked me when was a good time to talk. I said, today. Today was not a good day to talk. I said, but I'll be in the car. Call me between 6:15 and 7:15. I'm guaranteed to be on the road at that point. 6:16, the phone rings. He's like, okay, let's talk. You know? So I lost about 40 minutes of my clear head talking time. Oh, God bless him. Good boy. But gave him a lot of food for thought. So this is really, but I love the fact that people are coming out. Get a chance to talk a little bit about Judaism and ideas that maybe we don't necessarily take the time to think more about. So every year I try to come up with a different theme or a different topic to talk about in my classes. So I was talking to the Craigs and with Liz, and we were deciding what would be a good theme for this year. So I gave a few options, and what seemed to be the most popular option was heroes and villains in the Bible. Let's analyze some of them and to learn lessons, character development lessons about what we can put into practice in today's world. I'm a very, very strong believer that whatever we study, doesn't make a difference whether it's religion or any topic. The question at the end of the day you have to ask yourself is, what's the relevance to me? If you want to just collect academic knowledge, that's fine. But to live life, you want to tap into all the knowledge you have and internalize it and put it into practice. So what can we learn from some of the heroes and villains in the Torah? That was the mission. So I decided that for this part, we would get ready. The next holiday is Purim. Great holiday. A lot of fun, a lot of excitement, great wine. I'm just saying. Wine's a good thing. I once gave a class on the Jewish perspective of wine. And I got to tell you, the people were floored. I couldn't believe that I had an hour and a quarter worth of material to share about. It's like, okay, use it for Kiddush. Whoopee. You know, like, oh, no. Wine goes way back. So wine plays a very central role in the holiday of Purim. But if you go through the story, and obviously the main text is what? What do we use on Purim?
The Megillah
and Esther, right? The book of Esther. Great, great storyline. Hollywood can't come up with one any better. It really can't. But I want to ask you a question. If you had to pick Purim on one side of the calendar of Jewish holidays, you have Purim, what would be something that would be just as close, or would even in the name of it, you would even allude to the fact that it's like a holiday of Purim? Think of another Jewish holiday that's similar, even in its name. That was a big hint.
Passover
sounds like Purim.
Starts with a P.
Starts with a P. Yeah, it's got an R. Okay. Purr.
Well.
Go ahead, Joe.
You had told us before about Yom Kippur.
Yom Kippurim. Yom Kippur. The real name in the Torah is Yom Kippurim.
Thank goodness for Joe. Can I take notes, you know?
Okay. I count on that because I repeat this every month. And you're like, this sounds so new. Yes.
Fascinating. Again.
Yom Kippurim. So in Hebrew, they have the word Purim, okay? But when you have a kaf, the letter kaf before a word, at the beginning of a word, it means like. Kippurim could be understood as ki, like Purim.
Huh.
Now, you go, huh? I go, what? If you had to pick two holidays that would be on the opposite ends of a spectrum, you would put Purim, which is all festivities, joy, party, drinking, festive meal. On the opposite, the polar opposite would be Yom Kippur. All day fasting. There's no fun. There's no game. It's very serious. Why would the name of it, the holiday of Yom, the day, Kippurim, is just like Purim? It seems to make no sense. Right? No? You with me?
Yeah.
But let's make matters worse before we make them better.
She's your best.
She's my plan. I'm just like, we're gonna take this gig on the road.
She's your best
Okay, so Jill makes an excellent point, and that is they both share the common theme of where our lives are on the line and we're saved. I agree, but was that not Passover too? One could make the argument enslaved to a point of almost extinction, and God saved us. One could make an argument that maybe Sukkot would be that way because we were out in the desert. And miraculously, we survived 40 years in the desert with manna falling from heaven, water miraculously showing up in a well that followed us. Like, One could argue and say all Jewish holidays have one theme. We were in trouble. God saved us. Let's eat. They all have that theme. True. But there's something more about this connection, and we'll see. Okay? Work with me here. How many mitzvot, how many commandments are there to fulfill on the holiday of Purim? Oh, my.
I don't know.
That's a good answer. That's an acceptable answer.
That's a good answer.
Well, let's go through it.
Aside from like the daily...
Especially unique. Especially unique. 100?
Well, there's 100 every day.
100.
Oh, 100 brachot.
Right. 100 blessings that we make. But no. Mitzvot, they are uniquely associated with Purim.
Listen to the Megillah.
Megillah, right? We have to listen to the story of Esther, right? What
Mishloach
else?
Manot.
Sending packages, a food package, right, to Mishloach Manot, sending that person, right?
Giving tzedakah.
An extra measure of what's called matanot le'evyonim, an extra measure of charity, right? Giving charity to the poor. And there's one more.
Is it drinking? Wine.
You're close. It's not necessarily the drinking, but it is. It means having a festive meal at which you would have the wine. But there is a mitzvah to have the seuda, the festive meal. These are the four unique mitzvot associated with the holiday of Purim. Okay, make a mental note of it. But is there a theme? Is there maybe a message about all of them? Obviously, if it's unique to the holiday, it must contribute to the theme of the day. It wouldn't just be a random mitzvah. It wouldn't make sense that way. Okay. To really appreciate these two questions and how this will play itself out, it's time to meet our villain. Okay, we're going to meet our villain now. Who would be the villain of the story?
Haman.
One could argue Ahasuerus gets second billing. Vashti can probably get some role in all of this, right? But Haman gets top billing, no question about it.
I didn't know that Vashti, I always think of Vashti as a victim more than a villain.
We'll have to put it on our list.
Okay.
How did Ahasuerus become king?
By marrying Vashti.
Correct. Vashti is really the royal bloodline. Okay, Ahasuerus married in and then booted her out. However, she was a cruel, cruel, cruel lady who set the tone for Ahasuerus's rules.
I never knew that.
Yes.
Okay. Next year's
we'll
class.
We'll save it.
I'm playing Vashti in our musical.
I'm sorry. Well, you have a very short part then.
I do have a song that I sing. So I have a solo, and then that's pretty much it.
Because that's pretty much the end of that story.
I don't have lines. The tail.
That's it. Some polka dots. Got to get a little.
We haven't discussed what what
wardrobe.
How wardrobe, you know. But I figure if wardrobe is such that we can just decide what we want to wear, I'm going to wear a Vashti t-shirt.
You probably wore that to go to bed with sweats, you know? It could be. Who knows?
I would wear a nightgap.
A Vashti nightgap.
Just make sure you wear something. That's all I got to say.
You know,
a long thing.
Yeah. I just think it's something more glamorous.
Anyway.
Lingerie.
Yeah, lingerie.
So you have the villain of the story. You have
I'm gonna show up at the synagogue and we're in a
negligee?
No.
Okay. That's one way to boost membership.
No, we're not saying else. Victoria's Secret at the synagogue.
Okay. Is it getting hot in here or is it just me? Okay. Okay. So Haman, we're introduced to him in the third chapter of the book. That's really when he's introduced. Okay. I want to jump right away. Haman comes to King Ahasuerus, and he has what seems to be a strong argument as to why the Jews are to be destroyed. Let's see if I can find it in here. Who knows it's at the end? Here's what it says. It's in chapter 3.
We have that book.
This is your book.
I know. Good thing I have that
book. Oh. Here we go. Haman then said to King Ahasuerus, quote, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the other peoples in all the provinces of your realm, whose laws are different from those of any other people, and who do not obey the king's laws. And it is not in your majesty's interest to tolerate them. If it please your majesty, let an edict be drawn for their destruction, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver toward the stewards for deposit in the royal treasury." We got a bunch of people out there. They're just different. I can't change the words, right? They're different. Their laws are different. Their behaviors are different. They don't follow the regular rules of the law of this country. And if it pleases the king, let's destroy them. You worried? We worried maybe that's going to be have a negative impact on the economy. You're going to miss out on all these taxes. Don't worry. I'll replenish the treasury. I'll put in 10,000 silver talents. Talents of silver, you'll be okay. This is his argument. I want to focus in on the first line because I said it, but I didn't really address it. Let me read it to you again. Haman then said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people." Okay? In English, it comes across no problem. However, the Hebrew text is Yeshno Am Echad. There is one people. There is one people, he identifies, not a certain people. There is one people. Mifuzar u'mifarad bein ha'amim. Scattered and dispersed amongst synonyms, are they not? That's poetic. You got to be true to the text, folks. You got to ask, what is going on here? What is it that Haman is identifying? Why now? This is always the question that many of the commentators. Let's put this in the historical context. When did the story of Purim take place? Give me a time frame.
A long time ago.
I'm with you. It's a long time ago. Can we narrow it just a smidgen? Where are we? I'll even help you here. Where are we vis-a-vis the temples that were built? Okay, we're between the two.
The Babylonian captivity?
Good. So, Joe to the rescue. Did we do this already? Man.
Well, I mean, they're dispersed, so.
Did we talk about this already?
This, I don't recall.
So. Okay, good. I was like getting nervous on the way. I was like,
did you send him?
Did I do this? Yeah, did you
before?
Did you hack into my system?
While you were talking to the guy on the phone, I was
unbelievable. So Joe is right. Let me give you the historical context here. Jews are in Egypt. We have the story of the Exodus. We wander 40. Sorry, we got the Torah at Mount Sinai. We then traveled 40 years, sojourned in the desert under Moses' leadership. Moshe dies at the end of that 40-year period. His student Joshua takes over, leads the conquest into the land of Israel, takes them 14 years to conquer and divide amongst the tribes. And slowly they're living there, they're cultivating it to the point of where finally you have King David, which is about almost 500 years later, 400 and something years later. And his son, King Solomon, who takes over, builds the first temple in Jerusalem. That temple stands for 410 years. Okay? You looking for a pen to take notes? Perfect.
I'm just getting a tissue.
Man. 410 years. She's moved by the whole thing.
I think she was going to take notes on the tissue.
410 years the temple stands until, as Joe said, the Babylonians came, invaded the land, destroyed the temple and exiled the vast majority of our people. into Babylonia. They're there in Babylonia, and there's a, I don't know exactly how many years, but at some point there's a war between Babylonians and the Persians.
Is that where you get the Babylonian Talmud?
That's exactly right. That's correct.
The Babylonian what?
Talmud, the Gemara. The Talmud is known as the Babylonian Talmud. That's where we set up. That became the center of Jewish living. That's where it was. The Persians then invaded or fought a war against the Babylonians and conquered, took us and many others as POWs, and now we became under the Persian Empire.
What is Babylonia today?
That's Iraq. It's Iraqish area, yeah.
Okay. So Iraq and Iran.
Yeah, that's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Since Purim story.
A long time.
Long time ago. Okay? Fine. So we're now under Persian rule. This is now, let's just give it some perspective. How many years, let's do it this way. The Persians were under their control. The story of Purim takes place. I'll fill that in a little more detail in a minute. The story of Purim takes place. And after the victory, after we are saved, and Haman and his sons are all hanged, not hung, hanged. Yes, we all know that, right? They weren't hung. Your curtains are hung.
Is there a difference in Hebrew between hanged and hung?
No, no, no. So they were hanged. And what happens is that the next king in line, his name was Koresh, he gave permission for the Jews to leave Persia, go back to Jerusalem, and start rebuilding Temple number 2. That's the context and where this takes place. There are exactly 70 years from the destruction of Temple 1 to the construction of Temple 2.
That's not bad.
Not bad at all. Considering we've been exiled over 2,000 years since the end of Temple 2. Yes. But that was already told at the prophets at the end of the first temple era. It's still standing. The prophets are admonishing the Jewish people. Trouble is at our doorstep if we don't get our act together. God is going to do this and he's going to destroy it. And he said at the end of 70 years, we will return. Make a mental note of it, because part of the whole conversation as to when's the right time to do this plays a role. Haman turns to Ahasuerus and says, the end of the 70 years that had been prophesied is over. God is not going to redeem them. They were aware of all the prophecies.
How?
Okay, it was a well-known thing. It was well-known. When the first temple stood, King Solomon was well-known throughout the world. There were ambassadors that came from other countries to bring offerings in the temple. Yeah.
So the king actually knew.
Which king? The Persian king? They were aware that there was a prophecy for the Jewish people that God would redeem them after 70 years. And their calculations, it was the end of 70. And nothing happened.
This is like Raiders of the Lost Ark.
To some degree, yes.
Using the wrong calculations.
That's what it was. So Haman turns to the king and says, this is the time. And in case you're worried, and this is the part I want to focus on, in case you're worried, they themselves are not doing well. The words he uses are Yeshno Am Echad. There is one nation. But if you listen to the words carefully, you could make the emphasis on a different syllable and say that there is one, under normal circumstances, unified nation. Not one as opposed to two, but unified, indivisible. There is a people that under most circumstances are unified together. But you will look, King Ahasuerus, they are scattered and dispersed. Why two terminologies? Because number one, they are physically scattered one from the other over our entire empire. They don't have connections to each other. And they're also scattered or dispersed in their relationship with God. God is not going to redeem them anymore. Now's the time to strike. They are vulnerable. This is the time. Let's take this further. You'll see where I'm going with this.
Does the Talmud say anything about Haman's motivation? Like, why does he hate the Jews and not them destroyed?
What nation is he from? What's his lineage?
Isn't he a Malak?
I'm telling you, you Virginians are rocking it.
She is. Liz.
Yeah, he's from the nation of Amalek. Amalek is known for their ambush, the attack when we left Egypt, that unprovoked attack.
On the
weak, on the ones in the rear, the right, the old, the frail, that's what they're after. There is a certain, we'll save it for another time. Or Amalek doesn't need a reason. The world exists with always two opposites. We always have free choice. That's a basic tenet of Judaism. We always have free choice. That means there's two viable options, right? The fellow in prison, does he have free choice?
To do what?
Whatever he wants.
No.
Yes, he does. He just only has one option. No. He has free will, but he only has one option. If he decides he doesn't like lunch that day, what's being served in the cafeteria, does he have free will not to eat that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Can he go down to 7-Eleven and pick up a burger?
No.
Right? No. You only got one option. I love 7-Eleven slogan. I don't know if they still use it. They used to have 7-Eleven, freedom of choice. That was what it was called. Because it's brilliant. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, right? It's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're hungry. No problem. Freedom of choice. Come to 7-Eleven. We got Dunkin'. We got whatever you need. We got, right? The guy in prison doesn't have that. Free will he has. That's a human gift. But he has no options. For us to exercise our free will, you always need two options. In a global perspective, if the Jewish people are supposed to represent values and ethics, right? That's what God is giving us, a Torah. Well, there needs to be an alternative perspective that doesn't include God and ethics and values, so that every person has two options. If the whole world were bought into this concept of ethics and values, there's no choice. Everyone's just doing it. You have to have it. So in a global sense, and I'm oversimplifying it, the Jewish people and Amalek are at odds at all times. They don't need a reason to hate. It's the exact opposite theology. Okay, here's an important concept that I think will bring out what it is that we need to focus on from a character perspective. In psychology, they talk about a concept called projection. What that means simply is that I have a certain flaw. Okay, I'm not a good example. Let's talk about someone else.
That was good.
A person, not anyone here, all right, has a certain flaw and they know it, right? They're quick to anger. They're stingy, whatever character trait, right? You know what they find the most easily in other people?
Their own flaw.
That flaw. We project our flaw, whether it's an insecurity or a phobia or whatever it is, we see it so clearly in the other person.
It takes one to know one.
Correct. That is correct. Mm-hmm. I got news for you. Psychologists didn't come up with this concept. This concept is already recorded in the Talmud thousands of years ago. It says the following in four words. Kol haposel, whoever invalidates, meaning someone else, bimumo posel. It's his own flaw that he's identifying and invalidating. You're so attuned to it because it's you. You pick up on it right away. Did you see what she did? Oh my gosh, she was so quick to fly off the handle. And I'm thinking to myself, that's me, you know? Kol haposel, whoever invalidates and sees the flaw in someone else, it's bimumo posel. It's his own flaw that he's invalidating. That's what the Talmud says.
Bimumo.
Be with mumo. Mum is a flaw. Okay. So mumo means his flaw.
Bimumo.
That's a funny word. Right. Yeah. Right. It has nothing to do with cows. Okay. So whoever invalidates, it's its own flaw that he's invalidating. There's no one better to identify a sense of divisiveness and disunity as one whose very essence is all about divisiveness. Who recognizes that the Jewish people have disunity? Who's the one who recognizes that there's a lack of cohesiveness both amongst Jews themselves and Jews and God? Haman. Why is that his trait? Why is he so easy to pick up on this? Because he comes from the nation of Amalek, as we just spoke about. Amalek, it possesses that spiritual threat, right? To counter our view, right? Because they personify the capability of creating divisiveness. Let's talk about that. The Jewish people leave Egypt. Did they leave as a bunch of wimps? Oh, we snuck out in the middle of the night? Not at all. Not at all. We left in broad daylight, contrary to the Ten Commandment movie, contrary to the Prince of Egypt.
No, it was daytime.
It was daytime?
Yes, it was.
Okay, good, because it was. Many people think that we left at night, that the clock struck midnight, the firstborns were killed, and that's when we left. It's not true. That is not true. That's myth number 172. Mm-hmm. It's not true. We didn't leave till the following day. And specifically, even though Pharaoh came running and said, Moses, go, go, go. I don't want any more death and destruction in my country. And Moses said, not yet. We'll go on God's time, sorry. You no longer get to call the shots. You had your chances. So fine. So we leave. And again, it was a mix. Miracles, the plagues. I mean, it just demolished the most powerful country at the time. And we're traveling in the desert. No problem. We can take a few hundred thousand, a few million people through the desert. And we're traveling 7 weeks. 7 weeks. I spent 2 days. I just came back from Israel. I spent 2 days in the desert. And it's in the wintertime. 73, blue sky. I'm like, I can deal with this. This is perfect, right? But out of Egypt, in the midst of a summer, right? 7 weeks after Passover time. Think about it, right? So let's call it April. Okay, so now you're getting into mid-May. Getting hot, right? And we're standing at a Mount Sinai. And God, this whole tremendous production of the revelation in God. Da, da, da. Okay, fine. And then what? Oh, okay. Move forward in the desert, right? It's not, you can just imagine, and manna from heaven and all these things. And what does Amalek come to do? Nope, can't have it. Nope, nope, nope. We got to put a wedge somehow, some way. We can't let them go through with this plan. And they attacked. What possesses them to do this? Why? Right? That's your question. What do they want from us? Were we coming across their country? We weren't even near where they lived. They were much further away. They came from the north to come down south to ambush us. Not even like a confrontation. I hope it doesn't happen, right? But we're watching in front of ourselves right now, you know, a potential, you know, between Russia and Ukraine. I mean, this could get ugly, right? But it's head on. There's no sneak attack from the rear, and they're each going to claim whatever they claim. Not Amalek. What is it? Why? So I want to pick on one character trait that is Amalek's probably essence: arrogance. Where you think of yourself as there's no concept of another. It's my way or the highway.
Gee, it sounds like a former president.
One can pick numerous leaders on a local, national, international, and global level that have fallen prey to this. There's no question. It is a basic human trait that needs to be dealt with. Amalek is the one that represents.
Excuse me, someone's at my door.
Hi. Oh, Colin. No, oh, good.
Am I being too loud? The neighbors are recruiting.
I have a very good recruiter.
You did great.
We are.
Oh my gosh.
But why do you say arrogance is a basic human trait?
Because we all have it. We all have it, some of us more than others, but it's something that needs to be controlled. It's a general principle. All traits are within the human. All traits. The only question is, good evening. I remember Ellen.
Wish you came back for her.
I'm on it.
I've been on the street.
Long
address. Oh. I had 5. It's the first number instead of 4.
Didn't I send you the right address?
Probably.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
I'll give you a quick recap.
I don't want you to.
Can I take your coat for you?
It's sure. No, it's no problem. We're talking about Haman from the Purim story.
Haman is about the only evil I was telling my husband is the only evil one I know about.
Okay, so he's our villain tonight.
Okay.
So we're identifying a certain character that is within Haman. Haman is a descendant of a nation called Amalek. The ones who were infamous for attacking the Jewish people when they left Egypt in the story of the Exodus. The character trait that they possess is that sense of haughtiness and arrogance where there's no room for anyone else. I'll give you an example. You've all heard the expression, this town ain't big enough
for the both of us.
For the two of us. What does that mean? Why, where'd that expression come from? Because when someone is so full of themselves that their way is the only way, then you're right. This town ain't big enough for the two of us because you and I have different opinions. There's no room for all of us. Somebody once said, if you take out all of the conceited people, there'll be enough room on earth. Right? There's enough room. It's got plenty of room. Just get rid of some of the self-arrogance. Okay. Amalek is that mentality. They couldn't understand that there was another way to view life, that there are guidelines. There's a way of subjugating oneself to a higher being. They didn't want any part of that. And therefore, anything that was contrary to their view, I hate to use the terminology, right? But in many ways, it's cancel culture. I don't mean it in the negative pejorative sense in any political way, but the concept, unfortunately, has seeped into our world and our society that if you and I can't agree on something, then I can cancel you. You don't exist. Not that we have differing opinions. Civil people can have differing opinions. We can agree to disagree. But that is built on a premise that I can be humble enough to accept that there's another view. It's not my view, but there is a secondary view. If you're so arrogant, you can't see another way, there's no room for anyone else. Others can't exist. Amalek represents that sense of self, of arrogance. It's an antithesis to relationship with. Relationship with means I'm not perfect. I have what to learn from you. That's the beauty in a relationship, in human relationships. At least it should be. There's a recognition that I can't do it all myself. I need you. You need me because you can't do it all. And we work together to accomplish, whether it's in a marriage or in a friendship or anything else. But that's built on a premise that you're not so arrogant that there's no room for anyone else. I'm not telling you that this is a proof, but it's fascinating. When you look at the word Amalek in Hebrew, spelled with 4 letters, Ayin, Mem, Lamed, Kuf. Those are the 4 Hebrew letters. If you add up the numerical value, each letter has a numerical value. Aleph is 1, Bet is 2, etc. If you add up Amalek, it adds up to 240. I'll spare you, trust me. Come on, only a mom would trust this, right? 240. 240 is also the word rum, not the one you're thinking of. Rum resh mem. The lush in the corner there. Rum resh mem is haughtiness, where you feel so elevated. Amalek's numerical value is the same as haughtiness, because that's what it is. It's cool. And I'll just throw it out there. If you're into numerology, great. If not, just nod your head and we'll move on. When the Torah tells us, never forget what the nation of Amalek did. Never forget their ambush, right? Put me to the test here. I have to remember where it is in English. Then the Lord said to Moses, inscribe this in a document as a reminder and read it aloud to Joshua. I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and named it Hashem Nisi. He said it means hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will be at war with Amalek throughout the ages. There's a command. There's two places in the Torah where it tells us about this ambush from Amalek. One is in the book of Exodus, and one is in at the very end of Deuteronomy, at the end of Devarim, at the very end of the Torah. Remember what Amalek did to you on your journey after you left Egypt. How, undeterred by fear of God, he surprised you on the march when you were famished and weary, and cut down all the stragglers in the rear. Therefore, when the Lord your God grants you safety from all your enemies around you, in the land that the Lord your God is giving you as a hereditary portion, this is the one phrase I want you to remember, is the phrase that pays. Timcha es zecher Amalek. You shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget. Timcha es zecher Amalek. Wipe out, abolish, blot out the memory of Amalek. Amalek, I told you, was what numerical value? 240.
That's not good at math.
Okay, good note. Amalek was 240. Okay? Blot out Zecher, the memory of Amalek. You wipe out the memory. You take the letter Zecher, right? Remember the memory. Zion is 7, Chaf is 20, and Resh is 200. 227. Take Amalek, 240. Erase memory. Take away 227. You follow how I do this?
Mm-hmm.
You're left with?
13.
13. You said you weren't good at math.
That's
13. 100%. Fabulous. You know what 13 is?
It's
the numerical value of the word ahava, love.
Love.
Because when you get rid of the Amalek mentality, the Amalek that says, I'm full of arrogance myself, and there's no room for someone else. When you can get rid of that, you're left with the capacity for ahava, for love. And interestingly enough, the word echad, one, is also the numerical value of 13. Aleph is 1, chet is 8, dalet is 4. If you want to know about creating oneness, unity amongst people, how you can generate love, genuine concern for another, get rid of the trait that Amalek stands for. Get rid of that conceited, self-centered, arrogant haughtiness. When you do that, you now have room to have relationship with, right? That's what the concept is. Get rid. I can't go around them walking and say, hey, are you from Amalek? Great. I can't do that. Can't do that. So the mitzvahs in the Torah obviously are meant for all time. So what am I supposed to do with this mitzvah today? This is what it means, perhaps. That I have to work on myself and eradicate, blot out what Amalek stands for so that I can have room for capacity to have a relationship with others and care. Haman, Haman, comes from this nation of Amalek. He understands. He is, as we said before, projecting. He knows that his essence is all about, I can't have a relationship with other. It's all about being scattered, dispersed, not connected with others. That's what he's all about.
But is he talking about himself or
His people.
Not his people, us. He's talking about the Jewish people.
But his internal perception is that he's the spurs.
I don't know. I mean, do I know? It's hard for me to identify and say, I'm an arrogant person. I mean, my wife reminds me.
I don't think anyone ever says that about themselves.
That they're arrogant?
Yeah. I don't think that's a trait.
So that's why I'm suggesting, I don't think Humman sat back and said, I'm pretty arrogant. And you know what? I don't like relationships with people. And in fact, look, the Jewish people do that too. I don't think that's how it came about. I think it's just a natural thing. We all have tendencies. Haman's tendency was to see that in others. I'm only suggesting to you that the reason why he was so easily seen by him is because that's his trait. That's who he is, coming from the tribe, from the nation of Amalek.
So basically, like, he's a disconnected...
Full of himself,
but disconnected from, he's not loving my neighbor. He's.
I'm not saying he didn't have any friends. I'm not saying that, but you know, even a person who has a flaw, there's levels of it. It's not all or nothing.
A spectrum.
Thank you. Right. Hey, again, pick any trait you want. Greed. Well, there's those who are like ridiculously greedy and everything is gimme, 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 gimme. And then there are somewhere they have the other extreme of where a person's really very, not really so greedy, right? And then you have in the middle, you know, I'd like things for myself. Sometimes they overdo it. There's a whole spectrum of that. Amalek seems to be on one extreme and that's part of their nature. Did Haman have it to the nth degree? I don't know. But he certainly had it as a serious character of who he was. Once we understand this aspect, I think you'll appreciate this. And I really, it opened up the story in the Megillah tremendously. Esther is now the queen, right? Sorry, you don't have that role. Esther's the queen, right? She plays Vashti in the story, okay. So Esther's the queen. And Mordechai goes to her and says, the time has come. You need to go to Ahasuerus and plead to save our people. Right? Remember that part of the story? Most of us are usually spacing out around this time, like sixth chapter or so, fifth chapter.
Not everybody
reads
it all at once.
Right, okay. Some people still read on the triennial. Every 3 years I get through the whole story. So what happens? Mordechai comes and says, you have to go. She says, I haven't been invited to the king's. I can't just walk into his private chamber. I am the queen, but there's rules. She says, I'll tell you what, I'm willing to do it on one condition. I want you, Mordechai, to go back to the people, to the Jewish people, gather them all together and have them fast for me for 3 days. Remember this part?
Mm-hmm.
Fast for me for 3 days, right? And then I'll go in and what will be, will be. Right? She doesn't say it in French, but that's the idea. She uses terminology. She says to Mordechai, Lech, go, kenos et kol ha-yehudim, gather all the Jews, vitzumu alai, and have them fast for me for 3 days, etc., etc. She uses a funny term. Why does she just say, tell the Jewish people, fast for 3 days? What do you mean, go and gather all the Jews? Really? Mordechai was going to go door to door, right? Not sell anything, except, hey, let's all get together and fast. Right, that's going to go over well. Why does she use this terminology? So our sages point out, Esther understood. If the downfall of the Jewish people, what made us susceptible was our disunity, which Haman correctly identified, right? Because he had the ability to project and see that in us. We were disunified. She turns to Mordechai and says, if I stand a chance of being successful in this mission and God is going to grace us with a miracle, we have to rectify this one problem. We have to become unified. If the downfall that made us susceptible was our disunity, then we got to get it together. And therefore she turns to Mordechai and says, first and foremost, go gather. I don't think he meant physically bring them all together, but call attention to the fact that we are not unified. We need to come together as a people, wherever they are throughout the kingdom. But we have to come together as a people. Kenos es kol ha-Yehudim. Gather all the Jews together. Figure out a way to go and unify the people. Because otherwise, I don't stand a chance in the Mishnah. Watch. When Haman convinces Achashverosh to promulgate the decree, Megillah says, V'ho'ir Shushan Navocha, the city of Shushan, the capital, was bewildered. It was in confusion. The city of Shushan? It doesn't mean city of Shushan. It means the Jews of Shushan, right? We're the ones. Now all of a sudden there's an edict for our destruction. Everybody's like, ah! Right? Like the picture I have in my head of whatever his name is from Home Alone, the kid, right? Ah! Right? Oh my gosh. That's what it must have been like. But the terminology is, and the city of Shushan. How about the people of the city? It doesn't say that. And similarly, at the end of the Megillah, after the victory, Meha'ir Shushan Sahalav V'Samecha. The city of Shushan was celebrating and joyous. Not the city, the people of the city.
But not all the people of the city.
Okay, so then say the Jews of the city. What do you mean the city of Shushan was joyous? The city of Shushan was confounded. Why use that terminology? Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to share with you something you've never heard, unless you heard me say it before. Here's your trivia question. Who should I put on the hot seat? She's like, who is the first person recorded in the Torah to build a city?
Shushan.
Who's the first person? Sandy's got it. She's got it already. I could see her mouthing to Alan.
Oh, well, put her on there.
Should we put you off mute? Tell us. What do you got, Sandy? No? Who's the first person recorded to build a city?
Any city or a city for the Jews?
The first recorded building of a city.
Abraham.
Good guess, but wrong. Before Abraham.
Before Abraham.
Just like 20-something chapters before Abraham. 17 chapters.
I was going to say 17.
No.
Ooh. Still wrong, though. Before Noah.
Wow.
Oh, my God. Before Noah. What?
I said, I don't know. Who was
Methuselah?
I don't know.
Before him.
Who? Was it one of
Esau's
sons?
You're going the wrong direction. Oh. Esau's post-Abraham. Esau is his grandson. Jacob and Esau
are way later.
Moses is much later.
Yeah.
Going the wrong way. Okay, I can't go before them. But it's not Cain and Abel. Okay.
Okay, and then.
What if I told you it's one of those four?
Abel killed Cain.
Who's dead? Cain. Abel killed
Abel. Right.
So Cain's around. Yeah. It was Cain. It is Cain. Listen, it's shocking. It's shocking. And they'll show you just how shocking it is. Hey, it's very early on, you know, like it's not even like
a small city.
What?
It must have been a pretty small city.
It doesn't say that. But Joe, you're onto something. No, seriously, you're raising a great question. You're raising an excellent, excellent question. Here's what it says. Right after Cain kills his brother Abel, okay? the Lord is angry with him, and he basically says to him, right, where is your brother Abel? And he says the famous line, Jeffrey Archer says what?
My brother.
Jeffrey Archer didn't invent that story, but that it's here. Okay, it's chapter 4. Okay. Then he said, what have you done? Your brother's blood's cried out to me from the ground. Therefore, you shall be more cursed than the ground, which opened its mouth. You're going to work it. You shall become a ceaseless wanderer on earth. You, Cain, are now going to have to become a nomad. You will not have the luxury of staying put in any one place for an extended period of time. Which wow. Listen to what happens here. Cain says, oh my gosh, is my punishment too great to bear? Give me some level of reprieve. Fine. God says, I promise if anyone kills Cain, sevenfold vengeance shall take on him. The Lord put a mark on Cain, lest another meet him. Fine. Cain left the presence of the Lord, settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore a boy by the name of Hanoch, Enoch, as they say it in English. And he then built a city and named the city after his son, Hanoch. What the fudge cookies is he building a city for? There's only a few people in the world. There's no population issues. There's no city ordinances as to how big that and what permit did he get? Who did he go to? What the heck? To Anna, they go, this one was born, and Erod had this, and go through all the genealogy. End of story. Why is Cain building a city? Am I the only one that's read this book?
Yes!
The whole book.
Seriously, this is chapter 4. It's not even like you lost interest in the building of the tabernacle. This is exciting stuff.
Well, Hashem say that he was going to be a wanderer, or him and all of his descendants?
Him.
So did he build a city so he had at least a place to come back and
rest his head?
And
he had a city for that?
Right. How about you take Europe, I'll take Asia. Fabulous.
Who established the land now? How was there a land?
I think it's what ultimately became what we know as the city of Nod. There were no cities. It was open world.
And where did he find the wife?
That's another good question, but for another time. Okay? Why is he building a city? And again, as I say this all the time, whether we have an answer or not, the bigger question is, why are we being told this? Frankly, my dear, who cares? What difference? He built the city, and if you were building the city, what would you name the city? Quick. Come on, knee-jerk reaction.
Enoch.
You name it Enoch? Not a chance. Not a chance. You, Olga, you would name it Olga City. You, of course, you would name it after yourself. Everybody would. Seriously. Right? You name the first kid. It's not arrogant. I think maybe it's arrogant. But I think people do that. Why is the Torah telling me that he specifically built the city and he named it for his son, Hanoch? Who cares? This is not a history book. It's terrible. It is the worst history book in history.
It signifies the unity.
Okay, so now we're getting something. See, I hope it's called I Set You Up for Success. That's what a good teacher has to do. Listen to this. Why? Okay, you're all from Ashburn?
Ashburn, this is.
Yeah. We're not in Ashburn?
Yes.
Oh, where are you from?
I'm from Leesburg.
You and I are foreigners.
I'm from Western Loudoun.
I don't know what that means.
It's further.
Oh, you've been further.
Further west.
But when you drive into any city, there's always a sign. Welcome to whatever it is, population blank,
four, right?
But often it'll have some uniqueness of the city. Winners of the NCAA Division II basketball, whatever.
home of the hot dog eating.
Fine, fat, right? It got something. Who cares?
New York City.
The answer is, and if you think about it, it makes so much sense. You may not know all the people in your city. You may not know people down your street. But you know what? You feel an identity and a connection with them because they're in your city too. We're all Ashburnites.
Ashburnians.
There's a certain, and if there were to be, God forbid, an issue in Ashburn, you'd stand shoulder to shoulder with your neighbor you've never met.
Disagrees
with you on everything. But as a resident of Ashburn, I stand shoulder to shoulder with you. There's a kinship that is built, that is there because you share something in common. You're part of the same city.
That would be nice.
The concept. It's a concept. But I think it's true. We don't put it into practice as much as we could, but it's there. There's a certain pride. If there were a, I don't know, the city here or whatever, the national, whatever, the sports team, whatever. We won. I love that, right? We won. What did you do except buy season tickets and pocket, you know, the owner's, you know, whatever, filled his pocket. We won the World Series. We won the Super Bowl, right? Everybody in LA, we won. Who's we, Kemosabe, right? Wonder what I have to do with this.
There's a young woman from Ashburn who's in the Olympics, and everyone's like, oh.
That's ours. She's ours, right? Exactly my point. Exactly. A city has a certain ability to unify its people. That's the definition. In fact, Rabbi Hirsch points out that the word in Hebrew for the city, ha'ir, the two letters that are the most part of the root is ayin resh, air, which means to awaken. What a city does, it awakens within its residents a certain camaraderie because we all share that city. Cain was faced with a dilemma. He had just murdered his brother, and the legacy that he was going to leave for all time was that no matter how big the world is, brothers can't get along. We have to be apart. That would have been his legacy, right? As we jokingly said, how many people are there at the time? If you disagreed with your sibling, you say, fine, you take Europe, I'll take Africa. See ya! But Cain wanted to fix that mistake. He didn't want to leave that as the legacy. So he tried to do something that sent a different message. And he built a city. A city whose message is, we have to get along. We find commonality. Awaken that sense of camaraderie. Not because they needed it for space reasons, spatial issues, but to get that sense, that feeling of camaraderie. And that's perhaps why he named it for his child. It's not him. It's about an ongoing legacy, an educational message for the future, the next generation. Not surprisingly, in Hebrew, that child's name, which in English we said was Enoch, in Hebrew is Chanoch. The word Chanoch comes from the Hebrew word Chinuch, which means education. He named the city as an educational lesson for the future of what we need to do. Find ways and means to combine, to unify, find commonality.
Did Cain make this decision to do this by himself, or was he commanded?
No, on his own. He wanted to change his perspective. He wanted to change his image to try to correct a mistake.
How insightful.
Thank you. I can't take credit. I read it somewhere. Okay? Perhaps that's the reason why the Megillah, when it describes that feeling of anxiety that the Jewish people felt when they heard about the edict, it says, and the city of Shushan felt bewildered. Because it was beginning to start that feeling of, whoa, 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 whoa. We're all in this together. You and I didn't agree yesterday on a lot of political issues or whatever the issue is. But you know what? It's a message Hitler taught us. It didn't matter if you were religious, it didn't matter if you're not religious. A Jew is a Jew is a Jew. I don't care. It built a certain sense of, we're in this together. it started the city of Shushan. I meant the people, but the city of Shushan was bewildered. And at the end of the story, when there was a miraculous saving, the city of Shushan rejoiced because we had come together unified. Because Esther put it right. If you want me to go to Ahasuerus and plead for the Jewish people, then we have to get God on our side. Get God's blessing on this. And the only way to do that is to start unifying ourselves. What a great message. With this, we can come full circle now and answer the two original questions. We asked, there are four mitzvot that are associated uniquely, specifically for the holiday of Purim. The reading of the Megillah. Where do we do that? In the synagogue. Can one fulfill the mitzvah of reading the Megillah in their own home? The answer is yes. Yes.
Or in your home.
Or in my home. You can do it anywhere. But we don't. We purposely come together as a congregation. You'll see how the whole theme of the day is what can we do to bring us closer together, unified. We come together to read the Megillah. We give extra charity to the poor. We have a meal. When's the last time a Jewish family had a meal and didn't invite company? Right? Pre-COVID. Right? It's just the nature of it. You get people together. That's what a meal is. Right? And what was the fourth?
Mishlachmanas.
We send food packages one to another. We're trying to improve. We're trying to send the message, I care about you. Relationship with the antithesis of Amalek. I care about you. You do matter to me. We are in this together. Everything about this holiday is about we can come together, unified. Now, we can maybe understand why the two holidays, Purim and Yom Kippur. If you recall, we know that the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, we're asking God forgiveness, right? That's what it's all about. But you can divide, not you, people who have sinned. Well, people we may know, present company excluded. There's two classifications in where we transgress. One is in our relationship with God, and one is our relationship with others. Bein Adam LaMakom, between man and God, and Bein Adam LaChavera, between man and his fellow. Those are the two categories. If I don't, for example, let's say I don't keep kosher, or I don't, for me, I'm not talking about anybody else, for me not to eat kosher, that doesn't have any impact on my relationship with you. That's between me and God. My not keeping Shabbos, that's between me and God. But my speaking negatively, Lashon Hara, about you, Tahar, that impacts our relationship. Mm-hmm. So all things that we do fit into one of those two categories. Well, the rule is as follows. On Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, we're going to ask God forgiveness. God says, I'm willing to forgive. I know you didn't mean it, and you're committing yourself not to do it again, trying your best, and all the requirements of what Yom Kippur asks of us, right? But God also says, I can forgive you on sins that are interpersonal relationships until you ask the person for forgiveness. I can't grant that. You have to. So the theme of Yom Kippur is similar to Purim. I have to repair any relationship that I may have had with a person over the course of the year. And maybe there was a divisiveness. Maybe there was a fallout, a wedge. It's my responsibility pre-Yom Kippur to correct that and ask forgiveness. Purim and Yom Kippurim are very similar in that regard. It's all about repairing relationships, unifying our relationship with each other and with God. They share that in common. To me, this is a powerful message that we learn from the story of Purim. And I bring it out tonight because the one who identified it better than anyone else was the villain, Haman. He identified that disunity amongst us and knew that's why we were vulnerable. This is the time to strike, because that's the Achilles heel of the Jewish people. When we're disunified, we can't get along. We're doomed. Comes along the story of Purim and says, that's what we have to correct. We have to learn from the villain's message, who knew us well, that that's where we were vulnerable. That's what we need to fix. And all the mitzvah associated with that holiday of Purim are all about fixing, rectifying, bringing together people. That's what it's all about. I'll go even further. One last point, because it's late. I want to suggest, and I may have heard this somewhere, maybe it's not my own, maybe that's why we're so into masks and costumes on Purim. It's not just for the festivities, because it basically says, I don't care what you look like, whoever it is. It's not a matter of, I need to know every aspect of you before I decide whether I'm going to like you or not. Mm. You can wear a mask. You can wear a mask. I can wear a mask. Doesn't matter. We're all together. Doesn't matter. All the little things that differentiate us. I have a bigger nose. I have a smaller nose. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Those are superficial things that really, at the end of the day, don't matter. So it's behind the mask. That's real. And that's all that matters. That's the theme. And I, to me, this was very insightful of what you can learn from a villain. Because let's not give him credit here. He was out to destroy us. But you see how he saw us. That gives us an insight of what we need to fix. That's my thought. And I'm sticking to it.
That was good. What do you think?
Good.
Yeah, what happened to him?
He got hanged.
And all his sons.
And his sons.
On the gallows that they built from the Lippi.
Ten sons.
Poetic justice.
It was. Irony. God has a very, very interesting sense of humor. Don't mess with him. Any questions?
I have a question.
Please.
It's a little, it's related to something you said, but not related to Haman or Purim. When you ask forgiveness to a person you may have transgressed against, do you, on Yom Kippur or prior to Yom Kippur, do you have to identify the transgression specifically?
Great question.
I was saving it for the end.
It's an excellent question. The honest answer is it's better to. However, we all know that sometimes, while the truth is really important, it could be more devastating. And sometimes it's better to say, I don't really want to discuss it, but I feel terrible. I said something I shouldn't have, or I did something I shouldn't have, and it's bothering me. Can you forgive me? The person, I think, if you came with sincerity, they're not going to push you on it and force you to say it. And you can leave it at that. As a kid, I'm one of three. I have my oldest is a sister, and then I have an older brother, and I'm the baby. And before Yom Kippur, of course, we were always taught that, you know, you have to ask forgiveness. So in Hebrew, we say, are you mochel me? Mechila is a term for forgiveness. Are you mochel me? And that became like the phrase. And every Erev of Yom Kippur, every time, Dina, what? You mochel me? I'm like, what? You mochel me? Yeah, I forgive you. No, but are you mochel me? And we would say this phrase over and over. 40, 50 years later, we call each other up before Yom Kippur. Dina, you mochel me? You mochel me? Always. We leave my brother out of this.
So I know, like, in our synagogue, the rabbi will say, if I have offended you or hurt you, I ask for forgiveness. Are you supposed to do that with everyone that you have, even if you don't know that you did anything? Are you supposed to do that to every person that you have a relationship with?
Better start now.
I know.
It's all year round. I might as well start the day after Yom Kippur.
Oh, you are the.
Like, it's one thing if you know that there was a something.
So,
but you don't know about the thing that you don't know about.
Right. So at the risk of going up to a whole nother topic, most people are not aware. And I don't know if it's printed in everybody's Yom Kippur prayer book, the Machzor. I have it in mind. there is a prayer that is said pre Kol Nidre. Most people are not even in Shul yet, or they're there.
But that day.
Yes.
Okay.
Of where essentially that's the prayer. And that is, I am fearful of going into Yom Kippur to begin this holy day of asking forgiveness when I probably haven't approached everybody who I should have. And I make a declaration. This is like the key phrase in those prayers. I make the declaration that says, anybody who has wronged me, unless it's something that has like a financial thing that I have a right to recoup, right? If somebody ripped me off in business, right? And I'm suing them, I'm not forgiving that so fast. You can say that I don't have to forgo a business loss. Just, you know, the person wronged me, they wronged me. I can sue them. I have no problem with that. But if somebody did something I'm unaware of, right? When I leave and all of a sudden you guys are all sitting and you're like, oh my God, how did I just sit there for an hour? Seriously, whose idea was it? And that's fine, you know, right? But don't tell me. So Erev Yom Kippur, you make the declaration that says, if I wronged anybody, I forgive them. I forgive them. I don't want to hold it against them. And I pray that they, anyone who I may have wronged, that they should forgive me. I make that declaration. Can I say for sure that the person forgave? I can't. I didn't approach them. But that's for people who I didn't even know I hurt their feelings.
Okay.
But if I know that I hurt your feelings, and it's likely because I work with you every day. No, I mean this in a very serious way. The people who we most likely have to ask forgiveness from are the ones we're closest to, because those are the ones we probably hurt. The one person, you see your friend once every 2 years, it's likely you did a great job and not much to ask forgiveness for, you know? But your spouse, your kid, your parent, yeah, those are the ones you most likely, yeah, you should ask forgiveness. I call my mom before Yom Kippur, every day. No, you didn't do anything. You're so good.
You don't say, Ma, you're Muslim me?
You're Muslim me. but that's it. Remind me, I'll show you. It's called Tfilat Zaka. That's what it's called. It's a prayer. I don't know if it's in you. You check.
That's what the prayer is called.
Prayer before Kol Nidre. It's like, you know, everybody's like turning 35 pages before you get to Kol Nidre. Is all this stuff?
I think I've seen it.
Yeah, Tfilat Zaka. Read it in English. It's very powerful. It's a very powerful prayer pre-Yom Kippur, pre-Kol Nidre.
So you know the slang expression in English where people, something's going on, it's chaotic, and say, oh, such a big Megillah, right? Now, you talked about Megillah a little bit just now.
Right.
So
a Megillah literally means a scroll. There's five of them in the book of Tanakh, in our, you know, our holy scriptures. There's five of them. One that's read on Purim, one that's read on Pesach, that's called Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs. Mm-hmm. We read one on Shavuot, that's the book of Ruth, called Megillat Rut. There's one that's read on Tisha B'Av, that's Lamentations, Echa. And then one on Sukkot, which is called Ecclesiastes, Kohelet. Those are known as the five Megillot, the five Megillas, the five scrolls. But the word just literally means a long, you know, that's how they used to write letters, you know, on these parchment, and it was a scroll, and you rolled it. I know that when I read from the Megillah, right, I open up the parchment, I unfurl the whole thing, fold it over numerous times so that I can actually hold it because my arms are not that long, right? And I read it as if I were reading a letter with the tune and all of the Vayehi b'meach Hashveirosh. How do you know that the first person who heard the Megillah was deaf? How do you know that? Because it says Vayehi b'meach Hashveirosh. Who? Hashveirosh. That's the term. Yeah. That's the text of the Megillah.
Ooh,
Achashverosh. You guys got to learn Hebrew.
Yeah.
Can you explain, because I always find it so moving, what you and Chaim do about the Megillah?
Important. So there are many people that can't for a variety of reasons, can't get to shul. And there's somebody in Baltimore who basically coordinates and wants to know anyone who has the skill of reading the Megillah, please call him, let him know when you're available, and he'll, almost like a taxi dispatch, he'll send you to various homes.
Where you will then stand and read the entire thing in the presence
of someone. But I'm pretty good at it. I can bang it out. But that year,
a person who can read goes to the person and reads them.
Like multiple times. I read it in like 20, 22 minutes, banged it out.
But
all the words are there. We do that for Megillah reading, and we do it for shofar blowing on Rosh Hashanah. For many
you
people.
You go to people, yeah, if they can't come.
Yeah.
Does anybody know where the Haman Teshuvos originated? Like, why do we eat those?
His hat, his ears. It's funny because in Hebrew, I still don't get it, because in Hebrew, Hamantashen,
Ozne
Haman, the ears of Haman.
But where did
that? I don't know. I don't know the.
I thought it was a hat.
Right.
Yes.
Right. That's what I always thought. I've come across recently. I say recently, the last couple of years, certain books that delve into just where does this stuff come from? But some of it is like way out there. Like talking about the shape of a triangle in particular, and that it's, if you look at it from this person's perspective, it's a vav and another vav and another vav, the letters vav, three on three sides, straight line, it's a vav, right? What's the significance? And he ties in the whole story with the fact that there's vav, and he bases it on a verse, whatever. But for the average person, I didn't say it this time, right? I used to say average Joe. But right? For the average person, it's like, what are you talking about? Seriously? Like, there's got to be a much more simpler explanation. And I don't know. I don't know. I don't know the origin of Hamantashen. I know which ones I like. Yeah, I'm not a big prune guy.
I'm just saying.
What kind is
your favorite kind?
Apricot.
No.
Raspberry.
No, I'm getting warm. I do like raspberry.
Is this?
The moon? The poppy?
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't understand
Oh my goodness. I'm going to turn off the Zoom on this because this is going to get recorded at this point. But one second. You guys can still listen. I'm just going to stop the recording.